local music shows.
Well, you should see my story reading, baby. You should hear the things that she says. She says, hun, drop dead. I'd rather go to bed with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Cuddle up with William S. Burroughs. Leave on the light for bell hooks. I've been flirting with Pierre Burton because he's so smart in his books. I like to go out dancing. My baby loves a bunch of authors. My heart's a broken bleeding. Baby's just sitting there
doing some reading.
Wa-ba-da-ba-da-ba-ba. So I started watching some TV, played my new CD player too. She said, turn it off or I'll call the cops and I'll throw the book at you. All this arguing made me get dizzy.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Raiders on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have with me in studio Rebecca Modrick here in the studio, and Willie Carver joining us via phone. Willie, where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from Lexington, Kentucky. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, it's good to hear your voice, and thanks for joining us via phone, Willie. And we'll also have Martha Hickson joining us via phone at the halfway point in the show. Rebecca, today, and Willie, we're here because of the book Trouble in Censorville, The Far Right's Assault on Public Education and the Teachers Who Are Fighting Back. Thanks so much for putting this together, and we're going to get to hear some of the testimonials, the stories inside from the 14 people that you interviewed, Rebecca, and you're the co-editor of this book. Before we jump right into it, getting ahead of myself, everyone, as usual, I will read the short bio for Rebecca and for Willie, and then we'll go forward. Rebecca's first. Here we go. Rebecca Modrick is a professor at the Stamp School of Art and Design at the University of Michigan. She's an artist and writer who analyzes and critiques consumer culture, including COVID-era privatization of public education as parents began to refer to teachers as public servants, subsidized by their tax dollars and therefore answerable to them as consumers. Willie Carver is an American educator and author from Floyd County, Kentucky. In 2021, Carver was named the 2022 Kentucky Teacher of the Year after teaching French and English at Montgomery County High School. In 2022, he resigned from his position, citing homophobia. Later that same year, testifying before the United States House Oversight Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. Carver is the author of Gay Poems for Red States, a collection of narrative poems published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2023. Carver currently works at the University of Kentucky. Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca, for being here. Thank you, Willie, for being here today, too. This book gets ever more timely. Rebecca, can you start by telling us how did this start? How did this project start?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to see you.
And it was such a nice vibe in this studio. Let's see. So my work before this project was involved in critiquing brand marketing and brand messaging. But during the pandemic, my daughter was assigned to the Ann Arbor School Board meetings as a journalist student from community high school. And she was in the middle of watching one of the board meetings one evening, and this is when they were on Zoom and there were a lot of public comments. And she ran into the room that I was in and said, Mom, you have to come listen to this. So I went in and I heard a lot of parents describing the things that you described in my bio, such as that suddenly referring to the teachers as public servants, which was a term I had never heard applied to a teacher before. They're referring a lot to their tax monies as though they were paying, private school education to a public school. And they were using a lot of phrases like, you don't love my student enough, or you don't love your students enough, or you would be in the classroom even though you're unvaccinated. So there was a lot of consumer language, consumer kind of rhetoric happening that was very unfamiliar to me, thinking about the ideals of public education as a public good for, you know, creating citizens and very, like, democratic. This was very, like, much about capitalism and the consumer rather than the community. And so I started recording all of the public comments and analyzing them, comparing them with a lot of the language that was coming from Donald Trump at the time. And it was very similar, even though in Washtenaw County we're supposedly mostly Democrats. And so I wrote an article about it. And Nadine Callan, who's a professor in education at the University of North Texas, and I started talking about some of the phenomena in my article. And then she started to tell me, she was training students to be teachers, and she started telling me stories about what she was hearing from these new teachers, and we started listening to them.
And so important to actually start hearing what are the stories for people in the classroom themselves, the teachers, as well as the students, instead of how the parents are representing the story, like their perspectives on it.
That's right. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of ways that teachers can do this. They often don't post things on social media because they can be fired for that. They don't talk with the press because they can be fired in many districts for that. I mean, even in Ann Arbor, teachers rarely post on social media. And so it's really hard to hear from
post
educators.
Post anything, like not even
post
personal,
about,
or school.
About their classroom experiences, their work experiences, posts that are critical of the Board of Education or the administration especially, or of course, you know, parents and teacher interactions. Things like that.
And it's interesting because you're saying they don't post related to school classroom things or what they feel about what's happening to them from the administration. But even stories that you include, because there's 14 folks who are represented, their stories are represented in Trouble in Censorville. But it seems like one of the stories, like the person was just for what they wore to their classroom,
yeah.
is wearing a pair of pants instead of a skirt. Or a dress.
Right. That was the first story that we listened to. And, you know, it was stunning. And it doesn't fall into some of the categories we hear now of teachers being fired because, you know, one of the stories in the book, Matthew Hahn, who was fired for assigning a Ta-Nehisi Coates article.
Right. Yes.
You know, but that's one of the kinds of stories that we're familiar with. Or, you know, today we'll hear from Martha Hickson, who, you know, was harassed because she, according to her principal, went overboard in offering too many books for LGBTQ plus students. And so those are stories in some cases people are familiar with. I feel like we're still not, you know, don't know enough about those, most people. But the first story that we encountered, she was 4 days into a new position, first position of her career.
And an artist.
An art educator, right, for elementary school. And the parents were incensed because she didn't dress like the other teachers who wore dresses and heels, and she wore pants and a button-up shirt, and they accused her of all sorts of things, and she was fired 4 days in. And that's really a really interesting story in terms of a model for why the influence of parent groups can be so devastating because there's so much bias and a lack of neutrality and a lack of expertise about education that is, you know, is not appropriate for an educational environment. And so they were contributing, these parents were starting, they would start the school year off with a luncheon for the teachers, and they would hand out envelopes of cash envelopes of money to the teachers and tell them that they could use it in their classroom, but they didn't need to. And they essentially, use their money to influence the school.
Yeah, keep them in line, the teachers.
Right.
Because what do you do? How do you hand that envelope back
right,
in the moment?
Right, or how do you criticize, you know, if a parent then says, I don't want my student to read this book, or, mm-hmm. I, you know, don't think you should have that discussion, then...
Willie, let's bring you into this. How did you How did you become part of the project Trouble in Censorville? How did you find your way into this story? I maybe Rebecca wants to speak on this too as the co-editor, but how, what is your story, and how did you come to be part of this project?
So if I can guess, that's because they reached out to me, Nadine and Rebecca. I was battling the same sorts of battles that you all were just talking about in the classroom for probably the last 5 or 6 years of my time in K through 12, in which it felt like any single parent upset about anything had more weight behind their words, was given more sincere listening to, had more power than I had as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And some of those complaints, I mean, I live in a town, in a county, that has an active KKK.
Oh, no.
So, and not a very active one, but a small
but,
one.
But visible, like even now, like visible, you know of it. It's not.
Right. Yeah. And the Southern Poverty Law Center lists them, right?
So yes.
Those people have kids in the school, and those people get to decide what gets to be read and what doesn't, because it's not as if there's a consensus or a rule. It's any individual can complain, and that complaint is listened to. I didn't have a single example in the last 5 years of a parent who was upset when what they wanted didn't get applied to all students. And often those things that they wanted disenfranchised minority students. So I was named Teacher of the Year and found myself in this strange place where I didn't really know what to do. I didn't even have social media before I was named. So I was trying to emulate previous Teachers of the Year. And what I did was looked at what they did. And they posted positive things about schools and tried to lift up good things. But it just wasn't my experience. And so the day before I actually got to meet President Biden, which is part of the Teacher of the Year experience, one of my queer colleagues was suspended because she had a TikTok on a private account, and in the TikTok, I guess there was a song with a curse word. She hadn't made any sort of threats or done anything like this. She just had a curse word in a song that offended someone, and she was suspended for, I believe, 10 days. At that point, I realized this is untenable,
yes.
And I started speaking out very loudly.
And did you speak to President Biden when you met with him? Like, is that what you began, like, speaking out?
Yes. In fact, I began actually speaking out that very night before. I kind of posted online for the first time something real, which was, I'm proud to be a gay man, and I am a teacher, and I'm exhausted, and I don't know that I can do this anymore. And I had about 60,000 people respond to me. I think I had 200 followers. I then got to actually speak. One of the people who responded actually reached out for help for his child who was trans, and so I actually got to speak to President Biden about that. But I think all in all, me speaking, and I think especially being in a high-profile situation, gave me visibility. And so I thought, okay, I'm basically going to burn my life to the ground, but I'm going to do it as loudly as possible so that people can see what's happening.
But that's so brave, too, Willie, because I can imagine if they're, like, you just sort of offhandedly said the presence of the KKK there, like a group that's not historically known for being gentle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are like publicly then becoming maybe a lightning rod. I mean, maybe some of the comments that you received on that first post weren't the kindest.
I've probably been called groomer or worse a good 10,000 times in the last year. I've received very strange things in the mail, threatening things in the mail. I think at a certain point I realized, like, there's different ways you can measure safety.
Yes.
And going into a life that is in which you are constantly reminded that the sort of worst of people have power over you, or going into a life in which you see children being harmed by the worst elements of our society and being told, like, you have you have to implement this,
yes,
I think is much more dangerous to my psyche, to my soul, to my heart. So in the long run, I would much rather be visible and have some sense that I'm living an authentic life and I'm not causing harm.
And
I don't think I could do that in the schools.
You had done that before when you were teaching. I mean, you had formed a gay student alliance, and they were doing amazing work, which I don't know if you want to describe. Like, I was really impressed with some of the research they were doing, where they would learn about, you know, like the history of holidays in relationship to gay people. Do you want to describe that?
Sure. So I'm very much a believer in student initiative. I think what drives me as an educator is always seeing what other people want, seeing who they are, and finding ways to expand upon that. And so my students really were concerned about making the world a better place. And so they had a group called Open Light, which was dedicated to positive systemic change. And so they cleaned parks, they raised money for hurricane victims. And then eventually they realized our school is a very unsafe place for LGBTQ students. So they changed the name of the group officially to Open Light, an LGBTQ affirming club. It was actually the entire title. And part of their work was to look at the school around them and think about what needs needed to be met. So that involved getting a grant. They won a $10,000 grant to buy books with diverse authors. They created a curriculum that they taught themselves, and they taught themselves LGBTQ and Black history. And they focused on whatever they were interested in about those topics. And so they really would sit around and say, like, what do we not know? And it was like near a holiday once, and they were like, are holidays LGBTQ? Is there a connection at all, or do they all feel religious? And so then they literally created lessons. These students were, in fact, so impressive that Eric Marcus, who's one of the nation's leading narrative historians for LGBTQ people, ended up interviewing a couple of the students. They were featured in Time magazine because of the work that they were doing. And that work was totally silenced in the school district. You couldn't find it on the school website. You couldn't see what these students were doing. None of that was advertised because they were mostly LGBTQ students. And my winning teacher of the year brought that into the forefront of what was happening, because people in a small town were upset that there was a gay teacher. And that caused them then to be upset with the students.
Is that club still going on, or no?
As far as I know, I know that there were some teachers who decided to take up working with the club, but I'm not necessarily in contact with them anymore.
Yes, it's amazing to me that the students then created the lessons they needed on their own because they weren't able to have this in any of their classrooms. They did it on their own.
Yeah, and I think it's simultaneously kind of beautiful and sad.
Yes. Oh, completely, Willie. Yeah.
Beautiful to see these young people fight for their own right to know things. Mm-hmm. And really sad to think that in the United States of America in 2024, students are having to fight and teach themselves because no one will teach them.
In the public school. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a short break. Today on the program, Willie Carver joins us via phone from Kentucky. Rebecca Modrick is here in the studio. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Trouble in Censorville, the far right's assault on public education, and the teachers who are fighting back on the table with us. We'll be right back.
I will wait for you till the sun turns into ashes and bows down to the moon. I will wait for you. It's a long, hard war, oh, but I can grin and bear it, 'cause I know what the hell I'm fighting for, and I will wait for you. We were never made to run forever. We were just meant to go along. ground. I'm a bad man looking for takers. You're the finest thing around, so I will stand my ground. 'Cause it's cold out there, and you know some men.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Today on Living Writers, Trouble in Censorville, the far right's assault on public education and the teachers who are fighting back. Today in the studio, co-editor Rebecca Modrick is here, and we've got Willie Carver joining us on the phone now on the line, and Martha Hickson coming up in the next half. Willie, thanks for choosing that song for today's program. Could you say a little something about that?
Yes. That song, I'm suddenly blanking on names, which is what always happens.
Oh, wait, it's okay. It's okay. Wait, I can help you out because you sent the name. So where is it? In Your Love by Tyler Childers.
Tyler Childers. This is me forgetting Tyler Childers is like me forgetting Dolly Parton.
Live radio. Don't worry, Willie. Happens to us all.
This is what happens every single time I'm also asked, who are your favorite authors? Like, it goes away. But Tyler is a Kentucky staple and is living proof that country music, there is some still, some real country music that still exists. And this song, the video was directed by Kentucky's former poet laureate, Silas House, who is also openly gay. And it's about two coal miners who were in love in a society that did not allow them that opportunity.
Thanks for choosing it for today, Willie. Thank you. And that was, and you said Tyler Childer.
Yes.
Okay. And okay. So, you know, during the break, Rebecca and I had a quick word, and I was wondering, could you talk to us about education as a sanctuary?
Absolutely. I think for me as a young person, it was I grew up in a poor part of the country. And my parents were both really hardworking, but hard work doesn't matter if there are no jobs or if a coal mine closes down. So there were lots of times when we didn't have running water, electricity, heat, food. School always did. So when I think about school, especially for me as a young person, it was this sort of magical place outside of the harshness of reality. It didn't really matter, you know, which family members were on drugs or who might have had some physical altercation the night before or whether there was food or water at home, because school always had those things. And it also had calm adults who saw some version of us that we weren't yet, and communicated that so very clearly in their actions and in the things that they asked us to do. And I just remember thinking, like, whatever else is happening in the world, as long as there's school, I'm okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's why I wanted to go into teaching. And that model is a model that looks at the school as a community resource, that asks what does the community need and make sure that school provides it. And I think a model that says, how can I compete with my neighbor? How can I make their life harder and make my life easier and use school as the mechanism for doing that? How can I privatize and commoditize the elements of school so that my child wins and another child loses? I think that's the model that we're seeing. I think that's the model that is attacking LGBTQ people, because if we attack Black, Brown, and LGBTQ students, then they're going to be worried about fending off that fight by non-LGBTQ, non-Black, non-Appalachian students can do the work of school or improving themselves without having to engage in that fight. It's capitalism brought down to the classroom lesson, really.
And how do you see then it also, because if that's like the pressure coming from the outside community, how, like, that must change the classroom inside, the community inside the classroom too, even if teachers are fighting against it.
For sure. I think the biggest way is that teachers stop fighting against it. There are teachers who realize there's just nothing else I can do. I had a teacher come up to me after a local pride. This was in the mountains of Eastern Kentucky, who said that she had a fourth grade student with two moms. And some of the other students were harassing him and making fun of him. And so she stopped them and said, well, in our classroom, all families are valid.
Yes.
And you're not gonna say something mean about his family, and he's not going to say something mean about yours. So these boys go home and tell their mothers or their parents, hey, the teacher said I couldn't say this. And those parents actually called the school and complained and said, it's my son's political beliefs. We are not an LGBTQ family. It is wrong for that teacher to force her beliefs on us. So the teacher was actually reprimanded and told that it was against the state law for her to give her opinion on LGBTQ people, and that if those boys
were... In her own classroom.
In her own classroom. And it didn't matter if they were... Somehow now this presupposed belief that that a given student's political message matters more than anything else, it supersedes bullying.
Unbelievable.
And his teacher was in absolute tears and wanted my help, but then was also afraid for me to speak to anyone at her school, was afraid for me to say her name. So it became really hard to help her.
And this was clearly from the story, Willie, it sounds like then the administration, the principal, vice principal, these people were supporting the parents.
For sure. And I would even say they're supporting the complaining parent.
Yes.
Because the vast majority of parents are not anti anyone. I think they're just pro their kid and pro making it through the day.
Yes.
Those parents tend not to be very vocal. It's the parents who wake up with some agenda, who believe that it is somehow their inherent political right to sculpt what school looks like so that it mirrors their own beliefs and divides out other beliefs, who really control the school. And if you think of it using that KKK model, mm-hmm. if you have a school of 1,500 students and only two parents are in the KKK, those two parents are going to be complaining the most and making the most noise, and those two parents are going to control the curriculum.
And so what would you say to the other, like the parents that are silent? Like what do you think about that? Like, you know, there's this idea where good people, like we kind of like, sometimes people are like, well, just keep going.
Mm-hmm. I think most of us don't understand just how extreme the most extreme voices are right now.
Yes.
And I think most of us don't know just how fragile this system is.
Yeah.
And so I don't blame the parents who are silent, because I think they think everything's going to be fine. I would just say to them, everything is not going to be fine. All of the data shows that schools are crumbling. And until those parents speak up themselves, they're going to continue to crumble. My hope is that some of the negative consequences of what's happening might wake people up.
Willie, thank you so much for being here today. Is there anything, because I know we're coming to our time where we say goodbye to you for now. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we do say goodbye?
Only thank you for having us on and for having this conversation. It's a very important conversation, I think, especially at this moment where it sometimes appears that we only have two choices in politics. But the more local we go, the more choices we have. So I hope that anyone listening goes and watches the school board meeting from the last meeting, talks to some local groups to see what they think about what's happening, and just lends their voice, because an email to your school district will go a very long way.
Willie, thanks so much. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I hope to have a great night.
I hope to meet you in person one day. And thanks for all your good work out there. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
And this is Willie Carver today. He's part of Trouble in Censorville, the far right's assault on public education and the teachers who are fighting back. Rebecca Modrake is in the studio. When we come back, we'll be joined with another contributor, Martha Hickson, librarian in New Jersey. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
May have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies a rich lady who's crying over the luxury's disappointment, so he walks over and he's trying to sympathize with her, but he thinks that he should warn her that the third world is just around the corner. In the Soviet Union, a scientist is blinded by the resumption of nuclear testing, and he is reminded that Dr. Robert Oppenheimer's optimism fell at the first hurdle.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm so glad you did. Today in the studio. Oh boy. Rebecca Modrick is here, and we have Martha Hixon now joining us via phone from New Jersey. Martha, welcome on to Living Writers.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It's good to hear your voice. You know, before I'll just actually, Rebecca, while I'm doing this small thing, would you mind, like, Billy Bragg, you chose Billy Bragg, the song, for this part. Could you say a little bit about why?
Yeah, that's my favorite song, Great Leap Forward. And we didn't get to the refrain I really love, where he says, if you've got a blacklist, I want to be on it. But if you haven't heard this song, listen to it, and it's such a inspiring moment in that song and in life. Yeah.
So that one is one we can all, I think I'll be listening to that when I go home today too. Now, Martha, you're joining us from New Jersey, and part of the project Trouble in Censorville, the Far's Rights Assault on Public Education and the Teachers and Librarians Who Are Fighting Back. And librarians are teachers. I mean, thank goodness for you, Martha, and for everyone. I'm going to read your short bio, and then we'll get to the conversation. Martha Hixon recently retired after 20 years as a high school librarian. Her work has been featured in School Library Journal, Booklist, and CNN Online. Her defense of intellectual freedom has been recognized with awards from the New Jersey Association of School Librarians, the New Jersey Library Association, and the American Association of School Librarians, and the National Councils of Teachers of English. In 2022, the National Coalition Against Censorship presented Martha with the Judith Krug Outstanding Librarian Award, and the American Library Association awarded Martha with a Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians Faced with Adversity in recognition of her energy and bravery in the face of persistent and ongoing hostility while advocating for students' First Amendment right to read. So thanks for being here, Martha. We're glad
you're here. You're welcome.
Martha, so you are retired now, and you continue to advocate and to spread resources for folks to be a voice. You're a voice in the world, as well as your voice and story is captured in Trouble in Censorville. Can you talk a little bit about your story from the book?
Sure. My story from the book really focuses on a situation that began on September 28th, 2021, a date that I will never forget. And that is when the largest censorship attack in which I had ever been involved in my career began at my school. A small group of parents basically ambushed a board meeting and began attacking books and attacking me. They called me by name a pornographer, pedophile, and groomer of children in a Board of Education meeting that was recorded and lives on YouTube and has since been viewed more than 6,000 times. They ultimately challenged 5 books, all with LGBTQ+ themes, And these five books have become very familiar to anyone who's been following the censorship battles over the last 3 years. Genderqueer, Lawn Boy, All Boys Aren't Blue, Fun Home, and This Book is Gay. And that began a protracted battle that lasted from that September night until the following January of 2022, as they tried to have these books removed. I fought back.
Yes.
Along with my fellow librarians and community members. It took us a while, but ultimately we were successful in retaining all five of those books.
Ah, oh, I mean, that is, I'm here with Rebecca cheering in the studio for this. And it's so mind-boggling that this is something that you would be having to fight so hard for as a librarian, that, like, you have the expertise, you bring the books in, you know your young readership, you know the books that students need to have access to, and you actually see why on a day-to-day basis as well in your library.
You said it, and that's what really fired me up. When I realized, it was that very night, September 28th, I realized this is, you know, they're using the books, but it's not about the books. Mm. The way they talked about these books, and the way they talked about the themes in these books, it was very clear to me that they were really talking about people. The books were just a proxy. And the people they were talking about were my students.
Yes.
The kids who find a safe place in that library every day with me. We were all in school. We were all in high school. We know what it's like. It's a very vicious ecosystem. And kids find a way to be safe in certain portions of that school. And I am so proud that the library that I maintained for 20 years was one of those places where the kids who aren't the head cheerleader, the kids who aren't the quarterback, the kids who aren't the president of the student council can find a place to be themselves and be safe. And when I hear these grown-ass, pardon me, adults standing up in a board meeting to demonize these kids by demonizing the books that are about these kids, it made my blood boil.
Yes. And actually, it made more than that, Martha, by the sounds of it. Like, you had high blood pressure, literally. It took a real toll on your health. Like, these, because you were under attack, as well as your library, both things were being under attack. And you weren't being supported by your administration. That's why you mentioned earlier, you mobilized people in the community.
Right. All of that is true. And, you know, Willie sort of alluded to it in your last segment. And shout out to Willie. Yes. He and I have been dancing around each other for the last 3 years. One of these days we'll meet, but yes. He did a beautiful job. But, you know, the tale that Willie told is one of an absence of administrator spine, shall we say,
yes.
Administrator courage. And that's what I faced, too. But beyond the absence of courage, I was also faced with active acrimony from my administrators. Their attitude was, you know, I brought this on myself. Their attitude was, you know, they're not going to support me. You figure it out. They didn't want to get caught in the crossfire. So from that day, from that day, September 28th, I never had any idea when I was coming into the building what I was going to face. It was an onslaught of hate mail, shunning from coworkers, accusatory comments from my administrators. I didn't have a safe workplace anymore. A place that, you know, the irony is I had spent 2 decades creating this safe place for students,
yes.
But there was no longer a safe place for me in that building. And it all came to a head about a month later. And there was a day that was just the perfect storm of craziness, responding to hate mail at the direction of my administrators. A request came in from the business office for me to procure the purchasing records for all of these books. Fun Home entered the library in 2006, So I'm digging through all of my purchase orders to find a 2006 purchase order for Fun Home, which they've got a copy of down there. All kinds of requests coming in regarding the situation. The students from the Gay-Straight Alliance were coming in. They were all up in arms over this situation. And I found myself, when the kids left my office, my heart was beating out of my chest. I went to the nurse's office. She took my blood pressure. It was off the charts, 165 over 95. And when she read that number to me, I started crying, and I couldn't stop. And then I couldn't talk. And I understood later from my doctor that I was having a breakdown. They called my husband to remove me from the building. He took me to my physician, who I'd seen for 25 years. And I hope you can tell as I'm talking to you, I'm a, you know, pretty straightforward individual.
Yes. Yes.
Strong, confident, not a lot gets me down, but she couldn't recognize the pathetic pile of tears and mucus sitting in front of her. And
well, if you're under this sort of intense pressure, like with that surrounds you, and you also feel like you're not only fighting for yourself, but you're fighting for this place, this community that you've created, and this ideal of an idea of a library for these students who you know, because they were, for example, just then in your office before that moment, right? You feel all of that, all of the weight.
Yeah. The silver lining of that breakdown, though, was she removed me from the workplace for several weeks.
The doctor.
And Martha, would you describe what you did during your so-called break?
Yes, absolutely. The great part about that is, first of all, she directed me to a therapist. I had never availed myself of any mental health services for the nearly six decades I had been on the planet. Don't ask me why it took so long to do it, but that helped greatly. She gave me anti-anxiety medication, and now I'm sitting at home. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I now have a full-time job, which is fighting these censors. So I used my time and my energy to fight this battle. I organized community members. I reached out to the media. I wrote talking points. I created what I now call book resumes for each of these books. Compiling all the fabulous reviews for them, all the awards they've won, and I got ready for battle.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And maybe you did you also, or maybe Rebecca did. Did who reached out to Alison Bechdel to say, will you blurb the book? Because Fun Home was one of the books you made a resume for.
Yeah, well, actually, this is not my first go-round with Alison Bechdel. In 2019, the superintendent of schools attempted to have me remove Fun Home on his say-so, and I refused. I said, we have a policy and a process for how books are to be removed. If you want to remove the book, you need to challenge it. And he said, that policy doesn't apply to me. And I said, it sure does, because if it didn't, you could walk through this school and remove anything you want by fiat just because you're in the mood. So I fought him in 2019, and at that time, I thought it was the worst thing that had ever happened to me in my professional career. Mm. In retrospect, I understand that was just a rehearsal for the big battle that was to come.
You were
but that was
up.
my first encounter with Alison, and as a result of that victory, I saved Fun Home that time, too. I ended up with an autographed copy of Fun Home from Alison Bechdel, in which she signed it to me, and she drew a lovely little self-portrait where she's holding a process sign that says, Fun Home is not porn. It's one of my prized possessions. If the house ever catches on fire, that's what I'm grabbing.
Martha, what, let's take a short break, and then we'll come back. Today on Living Writers, Martha Hickson joins us via phone from New Jersey. Here in the studio, Rebecca Modrake is here. Trouble in Censorville, the far right's assault on public education and the teachers who are fighting back. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be right back.
Someday they won't let you. Now you must agree.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Today on Living Writers, Rebecca Modrick is here, and also Martha Hickson joins us via phone. Trouble in Censorville, the far right's assault on public education and the teachers who are fighting back. Martha, thanks again for joining us via phone.
And, oh, you're welcome.
And Rebecca, when you were listening, and I was like in this last quarter, as Martha was speaking and talking about her experience, there were things that you were definitely connecting to and that you saw is a theme, like through the other 14 stories here.
Well, a few things. And first, I mean, Martha's amazing and a real rock star in the world of librarians, and just an incredible testimonial in the book. I think it's a model for everyone. And one of the reasons for me is that, you know, like Martha, you were saying that you're describing many of the things that you did when you're supposed to be on leave recovering, which, you know, were all about, again, like fighting back. And you also had mentioned in your story that you sent greeting cards to the board members saying all you wanted for Christmas was intellectual freedom. And I was so struck by that because for me, that spirit of, you know, even in the midst of something that's traumatic, that we can always find, there's a possibility of like finding a sense of like creativity or meaning or making meaning. And I think that particular detail epitomizes that for me in the book. And then the other thing was I was thinking about the administrators who are supposed to have everyone's back. There's a point also in your story, Martha, where you confront one of the administrators and you say, you know, are you going to be making a statement on my behalf, which is his job to do? And he asks you why he should do that. He hasn't even considered the fact that he should do that, and you have to explain it to him. And this was a theme. This is a theme across most of the stories, that it's the, you know, the person who you should be able to turn to for support and should be protecting you, who's instead possibly actively undermining you, if not at least protecting you afterwards.
Yeah, that really was one of the most disheartening elements of this whole situation, is that people I had worked with every day for two decades, some of my colleagues began to shun me because they believed I was peddling pornography in the library. My principal and I had started as new teachers in that school district on the same day in 2005. I had taught in his classroom. He had brought his students to my library for me to teach them. He and I worked together on committees over the summer, working on creating professional development curricula. He knew me, yet he let this accusation stand out there without a word of public defense or even a word of encouragement to me. It was heartbreaking.
It's like you feel like, who are these people?
Correct.
Mm. Martha, you do have a well of strength within you. And it's clear to me, and Rebecca knows you, and so it's you're still fighting. Like it says, you know, in your bio, it's like retired, right? But what? So what happened after this? Like what's happening now? And yeah,
I am still fighting. I mean, just this morning I was editing talking points for a library in Northwestern New Jersey that is has a rogue, it's a public library, rogue commissioner who's trying to force book looks, which is a Moms for Liberty monstrosity that claims to provide book reviews. This commissioner is trying to force the librarians to use it. But since we saved those five titles in the 21-22 school year, plenty of other things have happened. We had yet another book challenge last year. That was to the sex education book, Let's Talk About It. Spoiler alert, we won that one, too. The book's still in the library.
Yes.
The harassment has continued. I mean, almost up until this minute, I was just online and saw some person from Colorado calling me disgusting and saying that I needed to be arrested and labeled a sex offender. Several of the people who were involved in attempting to ban the books in our school district are now sitting on the Board of Education. And sadly, in this latest election cycle, that board has flipped. It is now a majority extremist board. So my retirement was well-timed. Mm. But on the good news front, by telling my story openly, as I have done for the last 3 years, I caught the attention of one of our state legislators, Senator Andrew Zwicker, and he asked me, what can I do from a legislative perspective to help? This was 2 years ago, and at the time, Governor J.B. Pritzker in Illinois was just about to sign a Freedom to Read Act in Illinois. So I said to Senator Zwicker, take a look at what's happening in Illinois. We need a bill like that. And I am proud to say that 2 weeks ago, that bill passed the New Jersey Senate. It passed the New Jersey Assembly in June, and it is now sitting on Governor Murphy's desk awaiting signature. Wow. And I had the great honor and privilege of sitting with Senator Zwicker on the floor of the New Jersey Senate, and I got to press the yes button when it came time for his vote.
Well-deserved, Martha.
Yeah. So all this yakking I've been doing for 3 years is leading to something really positive. So it was the best retirement gift I could have gotten.
And again, you're not really retired.
Well, I'm retired from the day-to-day life of the school, but I'm certainly not retired from my passion for this issue, my passion for books and reading, and my passion for kids.
And what can other people do? Like, if there's, like, a call to action for folks listening.
I want to reiterate what Willie urged people to do, which is to plug into your school board. The school board is kind of the secret weapon of what is going on politically today. Steve Bannon even said it on the floor of CPAC a year ago, August, that school boards are the key that picks the lock. It is the training ground for some of the most extreme ideas that we see and some of the most extreme political figures who are coming up. So tune into what's going on in your school board. Attend school board meetings. Show up. Speak up. Same thing is true of your public library. Go to those board meetings so that you know what's going on. If that's too much for you, reach out to teachers and librarians, especially those who are under fire. Some of the things that sustained me in my worst moments were the cards and letters that I received from complete strangers who had read about my story in the various publications with whom I've spoken, and then also the cards and letters I got from former students who said, thank you for being there when I needed it. So many of these kids wrote to me now as adults saying that they were struggling with their sexual identity. They weren't out when they were in high school, and it was such a comfort to them to know that they were represented in their library. So please communicate with the teachers and librarians in your community.
Martha, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for all of your fight and all of your compassion, which is clear. It just comes through. It comes through. Rebecca, thanks for being here on Living Writers today. You've got, I wish we had more time, but we don't, folks. So thank you all for listening out there. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thank you to Disobedience Press for publishing. Disobedience Press is an imprint of Michigan Publishing. Thank you to Disobedience Press for publishing Trouble in Censorville, the Far Right's Assault on Public Education and the Teachers Who Are Fighting Back. You can get your copy. It's out there now since the summer. You can get these copies. You can also head to censorville.com to look at and to watch and to hear video testimonials for an amazing list of resources and places like support for acting as well. Call to action. Rebecca Modrake, thanks so much. Martha Hickson,
thanks.
Thanks for being here. Thanks to Willie Carver, too. Thanks to you all. Until next time, I'm T. Hetzel.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart,
Live from Ann Arbor, this is the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihani Swar, joining you for the second day in a row here on the radio. And I'm joined by Jonah here. Jonah, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hello, great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you on. And today we're just going to be talking about college football. You know, we're going to look at the top 25. We're going to talk about the playoff picture, maybe throw down some picks for a national champion because, you know, we're into that stage of the season where I think a lot is kind of determined, but there's obviously still so much room to prognosticate, especially this season has been so open-ended with just the expansions that have been made to the playoff picture and conference realignment. I think it's a very interesting year to talk about college football, although not so much if you're a Michigan fan. That's really been rather unpleasant and depressing for the most part. But yeah, let's just jump right into it. And we're going to start by having the AP playoff projection pulled up. So this is what our current college football playoff ranking looks like. So in the number one, we've got Oregon at 11 and 0, followed by Ohio State, Texas, and Penn State coming in at 2, 3, and 4. They're all 9-1. At number five, you have the other undefeated team in the country, Indiana. They're 10-0, followed closely by their in-state rivals, Notre Dame. We've got, rounding off top